Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. We are always enjoying our wise conversations around here, but before we get out to this one, if you're watching out on our YouTube, you will see that because we cannot sit safely right this moment doing radio at Fadley's and video at Fadley's and all the things we want to do there, I would encourage everyone to go out and check out John Sarbanes, check out Damie Hahn, the great Nancy Devine, Bill Devine, checking in, telling their story, showing some emotions. They gave me a shirt, Don Mohler. How about that, huh?
Crab cakes, shirts. I keep coming up on the short end of the stick here. I don't know what to say.
Well, I think you're doing fine. I'll get you a hat. We'll get you a shirt. We're going to be over at State Fair this week. He's upset that I have a State Fair shirt, too. We'll get you a
Guapo, you got them all.
Crab cakes for everybody. The crab cake tour has begun. Don, when we began this thing, I've been telling a story a lot because I've been pitching a lot of business to people on a crab cake tour and talking to local business owners about what I'm doing and how we've moved the brand and all these things that we're doing here. And I think the purpose of the whole thing in the beginning was to tell local stories with local people doing things that we may or may not be aware of. Because you and I went at it pretty good a few times. I think over Crab Cake at 7 West, if I'm not mistaken, where I'm like, all you damn politicians and the politicians, and you and I went back and forth. You're like, no. There are people here doing good things in the community everywhere. And, you know, after my wife's illness that begat Baltimore Positive and Bill Cole and Cole Roofing sort of inspiring me to do this and me to recruit you, that along life's highway, I book a guest or two, right, on the show that I say, you know, I want to talk about the why here. And you're like, and I could do that on my own, but I'm like, I'm going to bring the former Baltimore County executive in here to tell some why stories as well here today. So we converge here with good stories and Baltimore Positive. And Don, I'm going to let you do the honors here because, you know, I think foundationally running a county the way you did and being involved, it's organizations like this that are sort of glue for the community, right?
Oh, without a doubt. And one of the true community leaders is the head of the Y, CEO of the Y, John Hoey. John, hard for me to believe, I did take a look a little bit to bio, even though we've known each other for a long time. 15 years, is that right? I mean, I said, wait a minute. I hate that kind of thing, John. I said, wait a minute. John's been there, I don't know, 5-6 years. And I looked down and goes, oh, John's been there 15 years, which means I've been there.
I reset the clock every 5 years. So it's 5 years is good.
Just remarkable.
Started when I was 10.
Right, exactly. That's what I always say every time I publish another anniversary for my wife. I say, well, we got married in kindergarten. You know, that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. John, 15 years. What a journey. One of the things, we're going to get you, obviously, to go through the why story. One of the things I always say, I think for a lot of people, it's hard to believe this in this day and age, but the why in many people's mind is still a sweaty gym where you lace up the sneakers, play some basketball, get a shower. And I mean, and nothing could be further. You can still go play some basketball, but nothing could be further from the truth. What attracted you to the why 15 years ago? And why at that point in your career did you say, time for me to do this?
Great question, Don. And, I will be the first to admit two things. One is 15 years seems crazy. And I was not looking for a new job. I was not looking to go run the Y. So I was a guy who was very happy in his career in the private sector, in the for-profit education space. Enjoyed what I did. I was running the division of a public company. Very involved in the community, but spending a lot of time traveling all over the country and also all over the world. So I had a bit of a crazy schedule, and I was the single dad of a then 6-year-old kid, son. So the Y board came to me asked me if I was interested in interviewing for this job, and I thought they were crazy. I actually laughed out loud. And, I told them I wasn't interested, but they kept calling for some crazy reason. And so I agreed to meet with them because I saw the list of board members, and there were many people on that board that I respected. And I said, well, you know, I'll go listen to them. And it just struck me that, you know, I'm in at that, this point in the prime of my career. I've had the opportunity to do a lot of great things in my career and done, worked in several different industries. I had also spent a lot of time doing volunteering on boards around town and cared a lot about this community. And it just struck me, hey, here's a really unique opportunity to lead an organization that has great possibilities and a great brand, but candidly at that time was not really living up to its potential. And the businessman in me said, wow, this is a turnaround. And that's exciting. But the community person in me and also the dad in me said, you know, this community really needs a much better why, a much stronger why. You know, I could do that. So long story short, they offered me the job. I accepted it. I went and spoke to my colleagues back at the company I was working at, Sylvan Laureate. I was one of the guys who helped start Laureate. Doug Becker and Chris Hohen-Sark are the sort of the two folks behind most of those companies. They had by that point become good friends of mine. And I said to them, look, I've been offered this job and I think I'm going to go do this for about 2 to 3 years, get the why, you know, moving in the right direction, and then I'll come back. And they said, yeah, that would be, you know, we don't want you to leave, but yeah, come back in a couple of years after you do that. That would be a good thing to do for the community. So that was the deal.
So two or three years.
What did you find? So 2005 or six, what are we talking about here, John?
2006.
Okay, so we find the why at that point. So when I think of the why, I think of Dundalk and I think of my dear friend Tom Kapp in the 70s and early 80s. And then I think about the connection to Memorial Stadium, right? So give me a timeline on that because it's muddy to me because the stadium closed in what, 98, 99, 01, it got ripped down. I mean, were you in or out at that point of the why when I was over there with Cal Ripken and Brooks Robinson 15 years ago or whenever it was?
The Y at 33rd Street had just been built. So I won't take any credit for that, but I'll come back to that in a little bit.
Well, that must have been a nice little recruitment tool for you that at least there was a foundation.
Yeah, I mean, they
you could see something, right?
It was the first time they had done anything, quite candidly, in a very, very long time. And so it was a great project. I mean, I thought.
Who was behind that? Was that a Schaefer thing, an O'Malley thing? Who was into that?
Schaefer and O'Malley. I think it was sort of a brokered settlement. There were a lot of ideas for that site, as you can imagine.
Oh, I remember. I talked about every one of them. I've been on the radio for 30 years,
you know,
John.
Hopkins wanted it all because they are, you know, and Hopkins is great, and they want every piece of real estate they can get their hands on. The community was not excited by that. So I think over.
If Hopkins wants to buy my condo, it's on the market, Mueller and Gary Realty. Don, tell him. Yeah, there you go. All right, just so you know.
Absolutely.
Anybody there wants it?
I think at the end of the day, a lot of ideas got out there. And the why was, it ended up with the why and this organization called GetCo, which does affordable housing for seniors. As well as other things. And so there would be real community benefit in that, having nice, safe housing for seniors who were on fixed incomes or less, as well as a community asset like a Y. The Y ended up with about half the property and GetCo the other half.
Space for both of us, for Don, you know, for anybody from Baltimore, right? Like if you say that that's where your thing is, that's a special place.
Yeah. I'll tell you a quick story if we have time for it, which
people do that all the time. Mueller does that all the time too. We're going to break and we're not running out of time. This is what we do here. We have,
all right.
So go ahead.
So, As you know, Nestor, and Don, you may know, I was not born in Baltimore. I moved to Baltimore in 1989 with Citibank. I was working for Citibank in New York, and they asked me to come down to Baltimore to work for the credit card business.
Who did you think your baseball team was then?
Well, the New York Mets. I'm from Flushing, New York. I don't know how much more Met you can get there.
We talked about 69 recently.
Yeah.
Not for long.
I will. I'll give you some other stories on that in a second. So I moved to Baltimore. I came here on a Friday night. I was put up at temporary housing in Cross Keys, right? 1989. It's in April. I wake up on a Saturday morning. It's an April day. Sun is shining. I didn't know anything or anybody. I didn't even know where I was.
But you knew you were in the place where Billy Martin and Reggie Jackson did that once. You didn't know that.
That I did know.
Just making sure.
And so back in those days, we didn't have the internet, right? So I bought the Baltimore Sun. I said, I wonder if the Orioles are playing today. They must be around here somewhere. And found out they were playing. They had a game that day. And what else am I going to do? I don't know anybody. So I buy a map and I realize I'm pretty close. So I drove over there and it was my first experience with the way they park cars in Memorial Stadium. I drove in and
not well.
I realized they parked the car right behind me and right in front of me. It was like a mob hit. And
that's why we took the bus.
But of course, it wasn't like I had anything to do. So I said, all right, I'm here the whole day. And the game was Bob Malacky was pitching. Cal was at shortstop. Billy Ripken was at second base. And Cal Ripken Sr. was the manager. So that was my first day in Baltimore. I went to this game. They won. It was fun.
Did it make you feel bad about beating the Orioles in 69 or no?
Not at all. Not
was
at
that 80,
all.
89 you said?
1989.
89.
That was a good year.
The why not Orioles, Nestor?
That was a good year for wine and why not, I think. 89. Yes, John Hoey is here from the Y as my guest, but kind of sort of the corporate local guy that Mueller would book on and their background in education. John, we're here to educate, and I would think for anybody that's driven by over on 33rd Street, and it wasn't Don that I got into it, but somebody on the air, because they all sort of run together. There are all these 30-minute dates with people where we talk about old stuff, but I couldn't drive down 33rd Street. I met my wife in 03, and I was really not over it then, right? And I think I went to an event over there around the opening, and then I went years, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, in that range, avoiding it. Like, I would get to Montebello, and I would go around it. I would go uphill, and I would go any way to avoid it. And my wife would, say, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, every time I get to the top of the hill, I look for the lights, and they're not there. Right. And it F's me up. You know what I mean? I said, about my dad and whatever. So it took me a long time, to not. So when I say sacred space, I'm good now. I'll come visit you. We can play some wiffle ball, do all the things I want to do. But, I think that stands at the centerpiece of my modern knowing what you do, but I don't really know what you do, right? Like, I'm a guy screaming on the radio. I live here. I think I met you in my hallway at a cocktail party or something at some point. I think it's possible. But tell us in 2021 what you found and where we are right now. And I guess over these years, the internet, social media, there's just so much more available to make something as community and centric as the why viable, right?
Yeah. I always say to people that the why is an organization everybody knows about, but doesn't really know what we do. And Don mentioned early on that understandably, most people think of it as a gym and a place to go swim, right? And some a piece of universal equipment in the middle of a floor and a couple guys, slugging away at it. And candidly, back in 2006, that was kind of my impression too. I can't tell you that I was in any different place than you were. And where the Y was back then here in Central Maryland was pretty small. We had this new Y that was just built at the old Memorial Stadium site. We had a few other Ys around the region. Don probably knows the Catonsville one best, that were in bad shape. I mean, I would describe most of them as bomb shelters on a good day.
I would tell you that the Catonsville one at that point was an embarrassment.
Totally.
At that point.
Complete embarrassment.
Yes.
And then there was a bunch of other, candidly, social services things that the Y was doing that were very, not very important. But there was no sort of strategy behind them. It was just sort of like, wow, there's a grant. Let's go chase that. And financially, they were losing money. So it was kind of, and I think that's why the board went after somebody who had business experience. So for me, being a crazy person, that all excited me because, you know, in my business career, I had done startups, I'd done turnarounds, I'd done a lot of different things. And I enjoy, you know, I think like a lot of people do, a challenge or a problem to solve, right? In my mind, the Y had this very interesting brand. So the fact that you had a brand that everybody at least heard of, you know, that's a, most people don't start from that place.
What was the mission as you came in? Was their mission statement then different than now? Or
no,
what were they trying to do when you found them?
Mission statement has been the same for a long time, which is to help individuals, families, and communities improve themselves in mind, body, spirit. You know, that's sort of a... But that's a fairly general statement, I must say, right?
And then there's executing upon that and saying, what does that really mean, right?
Well, people, I think, John, where people would be shocked, and I think it's what Nestor is drilling down to, is this incredible growth under your leadership. Right. I mean, when you look, if I were to tell folks, you know, you have more than 40,000 volunteer hours, I mean, that... 40,000, that's a big number, that you served over almost 630,000 meals. Talk to people, that really caught my attention. Talk to folks about feeding in a time when we're all so worried about food insecurity. Here's the Y, feeding 630,000 people. Talk a little bit about that program.
Well, let me enter that with sort of a quick, to your point, we started in 2006. You know, by the time COVID hit, we had grown the Y three times as large. We really had built out a strategy in which we were much more holistic in what we were trying to do to serve communities, families, individuals. We had really become the largest organization serving early childhood. We're the largest Head Start provider in the region. After school, community schools. We serve, we're the largest health and wellness provider in the region. And so our view is that you really have to reach scale to have impact. There are tons of great organizations around town, just a ton of them. We're trying to operate at a systems level, not a program level, right? We're trying to make systemic improvement. And Nestor, you used a great term early on, which is glue. You know, we're trying to, we've become a society now that has really fractured. You know, social media and other things have really allowed us to kind of go off in our little cocoons and not interface with people who are different than us.
Well, the pandemic's
has made that
across
worse.
Everything, right?
Right. So the Y to me is the ultimate leveler.
Especially kids not interacting too, right?
Yes,
young people.
Kids. And so, you know.
Or stuck on this damn phone, right? Like crazy, right?
Like, right. Exactly. We're a heads down society in our own bubbles, in our own information ecosystems. And our job is to kind of bust through that and bring communities back together and bring people back together across ages, stages, races, political beliefs, health situations. And so that's what we do. And we serve, you know, we're at scale. The other thing, mentoring, we're the largest mentoring organization. So to me, you have to really operate at scale to have systems impact. And that's what we are trying to do now. And so, Don, you mentioned food distribution. So when COVID hit, food insecurity, which has always been a problem, just exploded, right? We know that. Now, look, we were not in the food distribution business. But what we do have, and I always say, you got to look at your assets and understand our biggest asset is we have like over 110 points of distribution throughout the region in some of the, including in some of the poorest neighborhoods and in some of the wealthiest neighborhoods and everything in between. So we partnered with Maryland Food Bank and others who they're in that business to say, we will be one of your key distribution arms. So we have locations throughout the community and we have volunteers. We have an army of volunteers, including members. And
well, it's been around so long, people have been impacted by it, right?
Right.
There are people that it's foundationally changed their life and you know that they're recruited forever, right?
They are. And
to a place they don't come back and say Catonsville's a mess like 15 years ago and I don't want to participate anymore. Right.
They stick with
us. This is where I'd say that's me with the Orioles, and that's where Dalton Moeller now gets sideways. But that's another story altogether, you know?
Fascinating and great thing about people who are engaged with the Y is they stick with us throughout their lifetime. And to me, it was like our moral obligation. And Don, I want to go back to the bomb shelter that was the Catonsville Y. It was, you know, when I saw all that, I said, no, this is not right. Our moral obligation is to give a why that people are going to be proud of, whether that's in Catonsville or Druid Hill or, you know, Towson, or you go down a long list of places. Like when you walk, the whole thing about our Y Family Centers, which is just one aspect of what we do, is my theory is I don't care who you are, what your income level is, what you look like, whether you just arrived in this country the other day. When you walk into a Y, you should feel great. It should be beautiful. It should have natural light. It should be an environment that makes you feel good about yourself and your community. So you walk into our space, our Ys now, and I hope that is what you feel. You know, we've got to stop treating people like, you know, people who have certain means maybe get the good stuff and everyone else gets what's left over. That is not our theory of the case. You go to a Y Head Start Center, which is serving people at and below the federal poverty level. That site looks nicer than a preschool you find in the wealthiest neighborhood in town.
John, and it seems to me there's so much to unpack in what you just said. And again, I will focus on the Y that I know best, which is Catonsville, which is now this magnificent facility. But you talk about trying to make the changes systemic that you and Nestor are alluding to. And it seems to me that the key to that is, as a leader, you always try to judge, are the things I'm putting in place going to be there when I'm gone? Right. You know, I think our most recent example is the Baltimore County Executive. I mean, I'm sure there were many reasons that the county executive decided to stay as county executive and not move on and try to become governor. But I think from talking to the CE and those around him, he recognized that if you're trying to make systemic change, you can't be here today, gone tomorrow. You stayed 15 years and you did that. You changed the facility. That's the bricks and mortar part. And now I'm going to talk about a part that's near and dear to my heart, because you said they should feel a certain way when you walk in. And years ago, as a principal, I had an area superintendent say to me, and I was very proud of it, walked in the building and said, boy, you can feel this place. They have a certain feel to them. And I thought, what's he talking about? You know, I don't know. We try to run a nice school here at Sparrows Point, a nice school at Catonsville. He goes, no, you can feel it. When I became an area superintendent and had 30 whatever schools it was under me, it didn't take a day to understand what that person was talking about. Some schools had a feel, some didn't. And I think of a young man gone far too soon that worked at that Catonsville Y, Jordan Taylor. Jordan, who was tragically murdered in Baltimore City. The outpouring of the community and the young people that worked with Jordan. I know it was a source of strength to his mom and to his family, but it spoke volumes, I think, of the kind of operation that you were trying to run. And I know you were aware of Jordan, you knew Jordan, you knew his impact. And I just think, when I think of the Y, I think of Jordan.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, Jordan is, he is sort of the embodiment, right? You know, and his family. The Y is about building community, right? And, you know, we rely on people like Jordan Taylor to be successful, right? You can only have, we are the ultimate human engagement organization. And so a guy like Jordan Taylor.
That's what your mentoring program's all about, right? Literally.
Yeah, we're gauging human, you know. And so he started with us, I think, in college, you know, as a camp counselor, and then just stayed and took on more and more responsibility. But, you know, just think about it. You know, there's how many kids across Catonsville and that just the broader area there have been impacted by Jordan Taylor paying attention to them and doing and supporting them and
thousands.
Them.
The answer to that is thousands, right?
And that is, you know, he is the embodiment of what we do, you know. And obviously the circumstances of his murder are just horrific. We don't have to spend too much time on it, but home invasion, you know, he's basically saved his wife's life by, you know, taking bullets. Turns out the likely scenario is the people had the wrong address. They were going after something. They thought they live, you know, so they, and Jordan was killed, you know, in his 20s. Right.
We hear this too often on the show too, right?
Yeah. I got spun up in a sort of 48-hour, 72-hour media storm there because I had the temerity to write an opinion piece that the Baltimore Sun printed, which asked, like, you know, why is this happening every day? And why is there no plan, no strategy? Why can't we get our elected leaders together? You know, I'm not a guy who wants to divide. I'm like, this is unacceptable. This is not, should not be a partisan issue. And, you know, the sad thing is there's just been more and more Jordan Taylors. Now, you know, I'm an optimist by nature. I believe at some point we will have the imagination and the
courage,
commitment, and courage.
Well, there's no doubt.
Sit down and really figure this out. And I don't, I have my own views, and I think we got to get it out of the partisan politics realm, because that politics are critically important. But when they, as you know, Don, you come from that world, at least spent part of your life in that world. It's, you know, partisanship helps people get elected, but it doesn't help solve problems.
And the good news is, John, we've talked with the mayor a number of times. The outrage and the frustration that you feel is clearly shared by Mayor Scott. I mean, I see we're involved in another shakeup now of the Baltimore City Police. The mayor has spoken openly with Nestor and me about his frustration in the past over clearance rates. And as you said, the litmus test that I always put on that is It's, can you walk to the snowball stand with your children or grandchildren and walk home and never give another thought to your safety? I use that all the time because I think it's a luxury that I have. If my grandchildren say, hey, Pop, let's go over to Opie's and get a snowball, I never stop to think if it's safe.
Or what time is it? Or is it dark? Which direction is that in?
Every mile.
I live downtown. There are directions we do not walk after 6 p.m.
We can't have that. But let's turn it back to positive again. John, what are you the most proud of that the Y does? In other words, when you're out and about, what do you feel best about in your 15 years? You say, daggone it, we've done some good stuff.
Yeah. When people ask me what my favorite sort of part of the Y is, it's like asking us, you know, who's your favorite kid? Ultimately, what I'm most proud of is the culture that we've built, which is a culture, and that's not just within our organization of the, you know, over 2,000 associates we have, but it's the culture that includes our members and all the people that we engage with, the young people we serve. It's a culture that embraces the fact that, you know, community is a real thing. Like, we really do have to rely on one another. We're a diverse society. And that's a good thing. That's a positive thing. And that, you know, our culture is to engage. Our culture is to accept. Our culture is to find ways to serve people where they are and how they are. And, you know, so programs can come and go. But at the end of the day, you know, there's an old phrase that I don't know if it was Peter Drucker was the person who came up with it, but culture trumps strategy every single day.
Every time, every day, every way, John. Yep. I mean,
if you can build a culture, which doesn't take a day, then look, you're going to have good days, bad days. You're going to do a lot of things right and you're going to make mistakes, but you will be resilient. And you will have people focused on the right things, right? You know, I always tell our folks, you know, my preference, even though we have a HR manual and everything like that, policies and procedures, but I was like, I'd rather to just have a short list of like, what, you know, act like your mom is watching you. Like, what would you do? Do the right thing, right? We'll figure it out. Do the right thing. And I think, you know, it's not perfect. We're not perfect. We're totally flawed like every other organization, human being. But I think that's, our people know that. Like, when in doubt, just do the right thing. And I that's what I'm most proud of. And I think when COVID hit, you saw that. You saw our people naturally respond. Despite the fact we got closed down, our folks, you know, it's been a long, tough grind, you know. But they stepped in every way they possibly could, and nobody questioned whether we should do that.
You know, John, it's somebody you know well. When you say do the right thing, you know, I think of Spike Lee, but it is so...
One of my all-time favorite movies, by the way.
It's one of the great movies of all time.
You give me a hard time about not watching movies. I'm shocked when people say they haven't seen Do the Right Thing.
It's nice that you saw a movie. John, he's deprived. He doesn't see enough movies. But somebody that you know,
I'm building a business,
well,
man. Come on.
I've told this story many times, but boy, does it make your point. Former Baltimore County Executive Jim Smith. When I had gone to work with Jim back, I guess it was in 2003. After about a month, I came home and said to my wife, "This is really fascinating." I said, "I've been two or three times when the county executive had some options put in front of him. Neither one were terrible. A was always probably more the right thing, the better thing to do. B was probably a little more politically expedient and would have been okay. And Smith chose A every time. Well, after the second or third time, I went in and people assumed Jim and I knew each other well before we went because we became such good friends. We didn't. We got to know each other on the job. And I said, "Hey, boss, I'm kind of new to this political thing. Let me tell you what I've observed." And without hesitating, he said, "Don, here's what I've learned. It's an easy lesson along the way. And it's what you just said, John." He said, "I tell people all the time, if you just ask yourself, what's truly the right thing? Out of the choices in front of you, what's truly the right?" He said, "If you choose that."
Well, he was a judge.
"Everything else takes care of itself."
That helps, right? Literally.
"Everything else takes care of itself. If you truly do the right thing."
Well, when you're a judge, the whole idea is to get to fair, right? Like fair. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I like anyone who runs a large organization or company, I have to make decisions every day that are almost none of which are black and white, that you've got to always balancing a whole set of things you've got to prioritize and you're going to make decisions that are going to piss off some people but at the end of the day, you got
to write editorials from the heart to piss off people. Yes. That's okay too.
Oh, I remember that. That was a little bit of a firestorm at the time, John. Yes. You jumped in it, and I think it takes courage to do that.
I'm not good at being quiet. I will tell you that. It's never been my nature.
That makes three of us, I think.
I think you've got to have a North Star. I think, Nestor, you referenced this earlier. I always say my job is, I didn't start the why. It wasn't my, it's been here now 160 plus years. My job is to make sure it's here another 160 plus years, which, I'm going to hand this baton to somebody else. It's, whenever that time is. And, we can't make decisions that are based on, what's good for me, what's good for the next 5 minutes. I will say people ask me all the time, what's the difference in working in for-profit and not-for-profit? My answer generally is they're pretty similar. The difference because pretty much all of my for-profit experience was in publicly traded companies. The good thing for me is I don't have to just think about the next quarter. I get to think about the next year, the next 5 years, and that is liberating. And people can demonize folks who work in the private sector or work in public companies, but it's a challenge because they've got that quarterly earnings thing, which is real.
Artificial to some degree.
Well, it's artificial, but you judge by a lot your share price, and. I will tell you that at least the folks I worked with in the private sector, they were always trying to do the right thing, but they had that kind of pressure, which makes you, do things that you wouldn't, you know, aren't the most strategically wise things to do. So we have financial considerations like everyone else in the why. I mean, we actually, because of our size and because of our capital needs, this is a pretty big financial engine we've got to feed every day, but we do get to think long term because we are a organization who only exists because of the community. We have really no other purpose than to serve the community.
John, it's interesting as you talk, Nestor. I think you would agree. Some of the most uplifting, certainly, and inspirational guests that we've had on, like yourself. From the nonprofit, whether it's Rachel Monroe from Weinberg or Sarah Heminger from Thread, who we absolutely love. I mean, they all talk about this sense of purpose. They all talk about this sense of building community. I mean, when I hear you talk, I hear Rachel and Sarah in terms of building community. I hear Sarah when she talks about making it systemic. So now people out there, John, they've been listening. They're motivated. They're loyal Baltimore positive listeners, and they say, "Man, I want to get involved. How can people get involved in what you're doing?"
How many whys are there and stuff now?
All right. Well, that's a tough one to answer, Nestor, because we do so many different things. We have 13 whys in Central Maryland. We have, but We have 40 Head Start sites. We have 38 community schools. We're in an additional 50 schools doing after school. We have 20 camps.
Is there anywhere
that I could walk or drive? 120 points of distribution.
Is there anywhere I could walk or drive from? I live at the Inner Harbor.
Yeah.
If I walk north to Hereford, west to wherever, I could run out of trees in Ellicott City? Or is there anywhere where there's a couple of miles where there's not something you're involved in?
No, not in this region. We have it covered. There's still more opportunity out there. COVID's obviously hit us hard, but we intend to continue to grow smartly, we don't grow for growth's sake. That's the other thing. But to your point is, if we believe that we can be helpful in a community by either adding a Y or adding other types of programming, we're going to do it. Because look, I was a kid who grew up, I didn't have a Y around me. I wish I did. I grew up fairly modestly, big Irish Catholic family, parents both.
We had a really cool community center when I was a kid. I give Don a hard time. This is a shout out to Johnny O. They're rebuilding my elementary school. It's 100 years old. Johnny O is going to cut the tape at some point. It's almost coming up. And man, when I was a kid in the summers, it was like they really did a great job of getting all of us together. And I was really blessed. And that's Baltimore County. That's East Baltimore. I always kid about Archie Bunker's Dundalk in the 70s. True. But the summer of 77, 78, 79, 80, didn't have a Y, but we had like this strong rec council that just made it work, big time. And probably on funds that we made from the carnival and, the snowballs. I have no idea. I'm sure Uncle Ted Venatoulis, I'll ask him how he was funding our friends over there. But I had a good situation, and I can't imagine what situation I'd find now if I had an 8-year-old kid in whatever neighborhood in the summer, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, we've lost a lot of that. I do think the city is hurt by not having enough, and we can go off in a tangent. I have tried for years to have the, mayor after mayor help me build a few more Y's in the city, but we end up building these tiny little rec centers that have very limited purpose and programming. And, I'm not,
it's got to be attractive for the kids to be there. That, but it can't be a jail for the kids, right?
Those do not deliver what a full Y can. And, we wonder why families move out of the city, and there's multiple reasons for that. One is it's not attractive for a lot of families to stay in the city. And I think that's got to get reversed. We want families living in the city. I live in the city, but I'm fortunate enough to have enough resources that, I can get largely what I need for my family. But, it's great schools, great communities, great, I'll be immodest, great wise, and safety, right? To your point, Don, you want to be able to walk to the snowball, get your snowballs with your grandkids. I mean, I'm a New Yorker. I can remember.
We're about to get to that because I'll wrap this with baseball. I promise you.
But I will say, in the 70s, New York was a disaster. We had moved to upstate as our family, but my grandparents still lived. And we pulled my grandparents out of the upper tip of Manhattan.
Well, remember, it was going bankrupt.
The place was bankrupt and literally bankrupt. On fire. Like right. it was like a, and
if people forget that.
Long story short, it turned around, and I have always felt like Baltimore could learn a lot of those lessons. And we don't seem to, we act like Baltimore is different than any other city in the United States. And that's just fundamentally ridiculous. Yes, every city has its peculiarities, but there are pathways forward. And I that's why I continue to live in the city and do what I do, because I do believe things can get better, but it takes political will and it takes a different mindset and getting out of your, getting past a lot of the things that hold you back, because most of those things hold you back. They're artificial, they're self-imposed. I believe everyone deserves a clean, safe, vibrant community, no matter what your income level is. And everybody, I mean, in my private sector life, I got to travel the world, you know, which is a gift. And I've been to a lot of places where I was the guy who looked different, right? I spent a lot of time in India. Like, you know, I've seen poverty like you've not seen. And my takeaway from traveling the world is a lot of things, but one of the key ones is at the end of the day, no matter how different we all are, we all want to feel a sense of community, and we all want to be treated with humanity. And that cuts across everything. And, you know, so if we can realize that and work backwards from there, we can, you know, we're going to have to, you know, think differently, but we sort of presume like those people either don't deserve it or they don't want, you know, safety. Like that's not true. It's not true. So, you know, I'm a hard-headed Irishman, so I just keep moving forward. And you know, I found the Y is like a great platform to really make change and make improvements, but not have to run for office.
I vote for him. John Hoey joining us here from the Y. You know, you know, you said the Y's, and I said, yeah, like my sponsor, Wise Markets. So obviously having an intelligent conversation. This is where it's going to like we're going to stick to sports, right? So you talk about courage and, you know, what I've done forever and talking about sports and deciding to do this along with some sports, by the way. But yeah, you mentioned that Orioles thing, like, you know, changed your life that day in 89. I mean, are you like an Orioles fan now? Are you still, you know, a Mets guy? Where are you at this point, John? 3 decades now.
I'll always be a Mets fan. I mean, you know, Rester, like where you grew up, you know, I fell in love with the Mets. Hey, I was born in Flushing. My grandfather, who lived in the upper tip of Manhattan, right near the Polo Grounds, when the New York Giants baseball team left to San Francisco, he adopted the Mets. So, you know, that's to me one of the
even though he could walk to Yankee Stadium.
Yes. Now my mom, his only daughter, was a huge Yankees fan. Huge Yankees fan. But you know, that baseball is one of the great things about baseball. You kind of most people inherit their love of baseball from their fathers. I mean, in my case, I inherited it from my grandfather, right? So it's so deeply embedded in me. And then I lived in New York, and you know, I'm a huge Mets fan. I don't deny it. And you know, but that doesn't.
Have you read Seaver? This is the book on Seaver that Madden wrote.
I haven't read it yet. It's on my nightstand. But I mean, the Orioles to me are just a great. They're a great asset for this community. You know, they've obviously made a bunch of mistakes, but.
See, I can run for mayor because I was going to say they were an asset. That's what I was going to say. It's exactly I look at them as this asset that has not been. I look at them as the Catonsville Y.
Underutilized.
05. How about that?
Exactly. And baseball draws you in. So I go to a bunch of Orioles games. I root for the Orioles unless they're playing my Mets, which is not often. Although in 1969.
Mom doesn't take me to Oriole games because I'm not any fun because I've been treating garbage for 25 years and I'm angry about it. So
yeah, you're not any fun on baseball.
I'm not right. Any fun. I'm really right. Not.
You're not a fan. Not. He's not fun. He's not an Oriole fan. So
That's not true. That's not true. I don't root against the Orioles.
Not a
That's
fan
not
of
true.
The ownership. He's a fan of the team. How's that?
Well, I think for the good – listen, you've been here for all of it. If you have something to say about baseball, baseball's important. I think that's the one thing I've always said. I live here. I look out the window every day. It's really, really important. And I would think, you know, to Wise in the 50s and 60s, everyone wanting to grow up to be Brooks. It was just his birthday. So it allows me to give a little plug for Brooks there, which is always great, which is also a grandchild of Don Mohler as well from a baseball family. But I would just say the fabric of sport and children and basketball and the things that when I think of the Y, I think of sports and activity and stuff to do and competition and fair play and teamwork and all of that stuff my pop taught me when I carried the bag up to Colgate Elementary to play Little League, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, we teach a lot of young kids. We introduce them to sports, right? Well, that's one of the core things we do. We introduce
and to rules. Your point is,
rules, right? Teamwork. You're going to fall down. You're going to fail. You know, the question is, what do you do next? How do you support your teammates? Are you a good sports do you, at the end of the game, do you congratulate your opponent? Those are the things you really need to learn. I mean, the skills, we also teach basic skills, which are critical to learn in any sport. But I mean,
well, this is going
to
be great because that's the glue. We began with glue. That's the glue,
foundation.
Right?
These are
societal
the
glue.
Thing. Right.
But I had another glue, lesson.
The
I had
foundational
another,
things.
Another lesson this week as we move to wrap it up. I love these. We all know about Michael Jordan getting cut. But if you're my age, you also grew up just enamored with Bill Russell, you know, the greatest Celtic of all. And I had no idea until the other day that Bill Russell was cut from the JV basketball
team.
Was
he not tall enough?
Who the heck? No, but I thought somewhere, I'm sure he's dead and gone, but some just like Michael Jordan's coach, somewhere Bill Russell's coach.
Who the
I
heck
got a
was
D
that
in journalism.
That coach is scratching his head and he's going,
it happened.
Might have whiffed on that kid.
Might have whiffed on that.
Hey, John, I'm glad we invited you on. I'm sorry it took us 2 years and 2 months, but here's the good news. The good news is we're doing crab cakes. We're doing this Maryland crab cake tour. So at some point, I want to hear about a central Maryland Y somewhere that's not even in the city, somewhere around that we can get out and crab cake it up and meet you somewhere out on the road in August or awesome. Somewhere into the great beyond. And when the Mets come to town, I'll look you up. All right. We'll go out there. You can give me, I'll look like Oscar Madison. You can give me a hat. How about that?
June 8th and 9th.
No, he's got the dates.
Sounds like some sort of high holy holiday for you.
Definitely a holy day. In the
you know what? I had a dude on this week. His name's Rocco Constantino, and I wish I still had the book here. He wrote a book on the color barrier in baseball. I would encourage you to go with Rocco Constantino. And he's a Mets fan, right? And he's like out in Santa Barbara teaching and doing stuff and whatever. And you know, we started talking about the Mets and the suffering and like – he talked about the day that the Wilpons sold the team and like,
oh, yeah.
He was like, it was like a day of freedom. Like I was kissing people. And I keep thinking to myself, that day's coming here. You know yeah. what I mean? I keep thinking to myself, at some point that new day is going to happen here. That and feeling that feeling was, that Mets fans had, that liberation, you know?
It was a feeling of liberation that finally we have an owner who cares, has the resources, and is willing to do it right. And I agree with you that, you know, you look at any franchise, any organization, you know, if it doesn't have the right leadership, it's not going to happen.
And that's why I tell Nestor, I'm feeling nothing but bullish as I look at Mike Elias and Madal and the guys.
Mike Elias doesn't run the place. We had this conversation.
He absolutely
runs. We do. He doesn't. He won't. It's okay.
Nestor doesn't want to believe that Mike Elias is calling the
shots.
Mike
Elias is not the president of the organization.
Anybody that's paying attention to what matters, which is the product on the field.
He's not Dick Cass. We go through this. John, this is why we can't talk sports. This is why. We're going to do the recon this week, and we'll talk about weather and shots and vaccines. John, stay safe. I want to see you out on the road and make you a frequent Absolutely. Contributor here. It's great having you on, really.
Right. It's really been a lot of fun. And I enjoy what you guys do and keep doing it. And I'm glad we had this conversation.
Thank you. John, stay safe.
We have great guests on. The segments are too long, Don.
There you go.
Without even talking baseball, without even yelling at each other.
Good stuff.
I still love Don. It's okay. It's great that we argue about something. It's fine, you know. Exactly. John Hoey here from the Y. Big appreciation him. All of our guests. Crab Cake Tour is underway. John Sarbanes joined us virtually. And by the way, Don, I want you to know this. On behalf of Congressman Sarbanes, I literally in the middle of this segment got the receipt that the crab cakes were received. So now I'm the one without the crab cakes.
There you go.
John Sarbanes is on the Y board. How's that?
Well, Nestor was taunting the congressman with these jumbo
holding them up
crab cakes to the point where he felt so bad he had to mail them to his house.
Yeah. Well, you know, that is I'm a torture. Giver. What can I say?
Thank you, Miss Nancy.
We are WNST.net, AM 1570, talking to Baltimore people about sports and good stuff and building the place up. That's why we're here. We're WNST, and we're BaltimorePositive.com.